Shrink Wrap Radio number 453, The Nocturnal Dreams of PTSD Victims, with Dr. Stanley Krippner.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
This episode of Shrink Wrap Radio is brought to you by Casper. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/shrink and using the promo code SHRINK. On today's show, I'll be speaking with return guest, world-class psychologist Dr. Stanley Krippner, and we'll be speaking about his work on the dreams of PTSD sufferers. For more information about Dr. Stanley Krippner, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Before we go to the interview, I want to let all you professionals know that our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has created CE courses from selected Shrink Wrap Radio interviews on topics such as dreams, relationships, synchronicity, trauma, and more. Go to www.jungplatform.com to see the latest courses. Now, here's today's interview. Dr. Stanley Krippner, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's a great pleasure to be with you again, David.
Well, I'm afraid it's been much longer than I thought. You were my guest back on show number 95 on dreams, and then on number 30 on scientific parapsychology. And now this interview is going to be number 453 in the series, if you can believe that.
Wow, you have been very busy.
I really have. I think I may have spoken to more psychologists, at least interviews, not as many as you, but it's been a privilege to speak to so many people. And I've interviewed some of your students here as well. Most recently, on number 401, I interviewed Christopher Ryan, A Critical Examination of Monogamy.
Yes, right.
Yeah, that was a very stimulating one, I must say.
Turned his dissertation into a best-selling book.
Yeah, and I discovered it. I didn't even realize that he was your student. I discovered him on TED.com, and then as I was kind of exploring, there was a link to his site, and then what do you know, to my surprise, there's a picture of you there with him. So I realized, oh, he's one of your students.
Yes, the name of his book is Sex at Dawn.
Yes, Sex at Dawn, right. Yes. Well, I know that you're going to be a presenter at the upcoming 32nd IASD conference, and IASD is International Association for the Study of Dreams conference in Virginia Beach in June. I know your interest in dreams goes way back and that you've been a very active member of IASD. Have you been to all 32 conferences?
No, I haven't, because some of the early conferences conflicted with our Saybrook University residential conferences, and I couldn't be two places at once.
Oh.
I've been at most of them, but not all of them.
Okay, well, that's a little bit of a surprise that you can't be two places at once. given your past involvement in the paranormal, do you remember how you first became interested in dreams?
I actually started recording my dreams in high school. I had some very vivid dreams as a child that I remember to this day.
Wow.
And so I would read the popular magazine stories about dreams. In fact, I actually remember the front page news of the local newspaper when Sigmund Freud died.
Oh, my goodness.
And so that launched me on a reading of Sigmund Freud. And so, of course, I ran into dreams. His classic book, The Interpretation of Dreams, was actually published in 1899. But the publisher decided to use 1900 as the date because he said this book is so important, this will be the dawn of a new century. And during the first year, it sold about a dozen copies. It took a long time for that book to catch on.
Wow. That was the first book that I read on dreams, as a matter of fact. I think I was an undergraduate at the time, but it made a big impression on me.
Oh, yes. A lot of it still holds up, and a lot of it has now been sidetracked by more recent research on the topic.
Yeah, one of the things that has really surprised me is how much of the broad outlines of Freud's vision is in many ways being confirmed by, you know, recent developments in neuroscience.
Well, of course, and we can't forget his colleague with which he had a rupture, of course, and that was Carl Jung, because much of Carl Jung's work, which has been scoffed at for many years, has now been confirmed by scientific studies of dreams as well.
Yes.
So, the two giants in the field, and we, of course, are still learning from them, and also Alfred Adler. I would say that Adler's position on dreams comes closest to the scientific research on dreams that we have today.
Can you say more about that? I wasn't aware of that.
Yes. Adler anticipated many things, and now we know that there are probably four basic reasons why we dream, that dreams were adaptive in human evolution and why they still serve an important psychological function. First of all, we do emotional downloading in dreams. We work through emotional difficulties, and of course, this is one thing that the PTSD survivor has trouble doing, which is why they have repetitive nightmares. They can't get the downloading accomplished.
Uh-huh.
Then, secondly, problem solving in dreams. And Adler was spot on. He could see that dreams often help to solve day-by-day problems in living. That's something that Freud and Jung didn't really catch on to. But Adler was very practical, very down to earth. Also, dreams help us plan for the future. Jung was correct on that. Jung put a great deal of emphasis upon dreams being a rehearsal for the future. And also, dreams help us to store memories. And again, Adler was correct in anticipating that. We store the memories that will be useful to us, and we sort of discard the memories of the day that don't really serve much of a useful purpose. So, if you take a look at any of Adler's books on dreams, you'll find that they're really surprisingly contemporary, and we can still learn from them.
Well, that's a great tip, and I'm sure some of my listeners will probably jump right on that. Have you ever had a dream that had a profound impact on the course of your own life?
I actually have had dreams in which I rehearse something that I will be doing in the near future. That is one of the functions of dreams, as I just mentioned, where I will be giving a talk, planning a conference, something very practical, and I am doing it in dreams, sometimes in very symbolic form. But it's like the dream is setting me up to do something like that in everyday life. Also, I've had some dreams that prepared me for the death of loved ones. I had a very poignant dream about my father's death just a few months before he died. And so dreams sometimes have a preparatory function. This, again, is dreams about the future. Dreams about the future don't have to be precognitive or prophetic or premonitory. They can be dreams that pull together information we already know and project it into the future so that we can be prepared for it.
How do you tend to work with your own dreams?
I have a program that I teach in my workshops, by the way, in which I go to the emotion in the dream. For me, the emotional downloading in the dream is very important. And so the emotion in the dream is something that I go to even before focusing on the content or the story. And the emotion in the dream helps me connect some emotional feeling I've had in the past, the distant past or the recent past, and then I take that to the dream content and see if this is something that reflects a past experience that I need to work through. Is that emotion confirming something? In other words, is this the emotional link to information storage? Or is that emotion planning to do something in the future? So I focus on the emotion, and then I take it on from there.
Yeah.
And depending on how much time I have, I can do that in a few minutes, or I can spend considerable time on that.
Okay. Now, I'm aware that among your many areas of expertise is work with trauma. How did you first become interested in that topic?
I've actually been interested in that topic since my childhood because my cousin, Marcia Gates, was a nurse in the Philippines and was captured by the Japanese and spent the entire Second World War in a dreadful Japanese prison camp, barely surviving.
Wow.
Had a cup of gruel or porridge a day for most of the time she was there. When she came back to the United States, she was a different person. The joy of life, the exuberance, the fun-loving Marcia was no more. She was very serious, but very, very wistful. She had an unsuccessful marriage. She said, "Oh, I thought I was going to find the bluebird of happiness." Well, she didn't. And she did some very, very good work with veterans. And now there is an entire veterans center in Wisconsin named after her, an entire book written about her in her honor.
But, oh, my goodness.
Yes, in retrospect, I realized that she was suffering from PTSD. Yeah, the book is called Angel of Bataan, and it's a wonderful testament to her. Of course, she didn't live to see the book, but her example has inspired many. And then, some years later, some decades later, I was working with two groups who tried to help Vietnam veterans. And again, they would often report recurring nightmares. And I did some research. That's where I found out about PTSD nightmares. Now, I'm not a clinician. I'm not a psychotherapist. But I was able to use my knowledge of dreams and the very useful therapies that people have come up with to help resolve post-traumatic stress disorder nightmares to be of assistance to veterans of the Vietnam War. And now that's carried over into the Iraq War, into the Afghanistan War, and we have literally tens of thousands of veterans who have symptoms of PTSD, if not full-fledged PTSD. Almost all of them have trouble sleeping. Almost all of them have repetitive nightmares. And
yes.
I would say that I've written three books on war trauma, and all three of them have a section on nightmares. One is a book that I edited with Teresa McIntyre on the topic of the psychological effects of war trauma on civilians. And then there's a book I co-authored with two of my students, PTSD, Biography of the Disease, and then a book I wrote with Daryl Paulson, another student, a Vietnam veteran, Haunted by Combat, Understanding PTSD with War Veterans, and all of those have sections on nightmares in them. I should say there are a lot of good books about PTSD. Some of them barely mention nightmares. I give it a big emphasis.
Yes. So what have you learned about that? For example, I think it was at an IASD conference, actually, where I seem to recall hearing that the nightmares of soldiers are not direct replays of the traumatic experience. Is that true or not in your experience?
Well, they're not exactly direct replays because remember what the brain is trying to do. The brain is trying to download emotions in the dreams. So the dream is trying to put that traumatic experience into symbolic form or into a metaphor. It fails. It fails. And so most PTSD nightmares are very, very similar to the traumatic experience, even though they're not exactly replays. Also, they're variations on the theme. They're a little bit different from night to night, again, because the brain is trying desperately to work those traumas through the system and get rid of it, just like ordinary dreams, which are highly emotional, where we get rid of unpleasant emotions by dreaming about them, except then we have more symbolism, more metaphors. The nightmare tries to do that, but can't quite hit the nail on the head. And so in doing therapy with nightmares, what we try to do is to help download the emotions. And there are many, many good books on the topic, many good procedures. Imagery rehearsal therapy is one that I personally like, where if somebody takes the nightmare and they look for the personal myth or the lesson in the nightmare, maybe the lesson is, oh, I'll feel guilty for the rest of my life. I killed a little girl by accident. I thought she was pulling a grenade out of her dress, and it was just a doll. I will never forgive myself. I will never be able to bring that girl back to life. Well, that's a very negative personal myth, and the veteran keeps dreaming about that. Of course, he can't change that, but he can change the personal myth to something like this. Yes, war is a terrible thing. Innocent people die. The girl died. I died too. A part of me died. What I need to do is to find some way to make it up for her. And the veteran can volunteer to work with children, can volunteer to work in a hospital with children who are dying of cancer or some terminal disease. The veteran can even give money to some of the worthwhile children's relief organizations. And so there can be an action component that comes out of changing the negative personal myth to something positive. Now, where does the imagery rehearsal come in? At the end of the dream, the dreamer imagines that the dream is still going on. And in the dream, for example, the veteran can apologize to the girl. He can pray for the family. He can add a scene on and say, I am going to do something to make it up as best I can. Now, this has to be very emotional, and it has to be rehearsed several times during the day. And as soon as the nightmare happens, as soon as the dreamer wakes up, the dreamer needs to visualize that image of restitution to the girl, restitution to the family, and produce a closure and repeat the new personal myth, the new lesson from the dream. And then during the day, I recommend at least five times during the day, the soldier or other service member rehearses that, draws it, speaks it, makes it go through his or her mind, and keeps doing that until the dream itself starts to change. Not easy. It's not easy, but the point is that once you can change the nightmare, then you begin to change other aspects of the symptoms of PTSD. Most therapists work on the symptoms using one of the very good, very excellent therapies that are around, saying, well, then the nightmare will take care of itself. My suggestion is to work with the nightmare first, and then there's a ripple effect that starts to help the therapy for the other symptoms. The basic symptoms of PTSD, of course, are very widely known. There's the startle reflex, where somebody hears a noise, jumps for cover, because they think that they're being attacked on the battlefield. So sure. Hypervigilance is a very common effect. Dissociation, where their mind wanders and they can't focus on what they're doing because they're back in the trenches, they're back on the battlefield, back on the desert. A third is problems with mood swings. It's hard for them to relate to people. They have emotional ups and downs, and it's very, very difficult to get those emotions under control, and sometimes the emotion becomes so painful that they do harm for themselves. And then also, in terms of the common after effects of PTSD, you have the deadening of emotions, where the veteran feels no emotions whatsoever. Emotions are just simply too frightful and too threatening. So as a result, the PTSD survivor, I don't use the word victim because they've been through enough and they've survived. The PTSD survivor has trouble with relationships, has trouble holding down a job, has trouble with self-confidence. And this is why personal myths, self-talk, attitudes, values really need to be changed, and you can start doing this right back in the dream.
Yeah, I'd be interested to go back a little bit to what you said about restitution. Did you happen to see the recent film called American Sniper, which is based?
I did. Say on American Sniper that's been reproduced in several different places, and I've even done radio and television broadcasts on American Sniper.
Okay, and so you know that that I've forgotten his name. I think it's Chris something. Do you remember the name of the central figure, the sniper?
Kyle.
Okay, that doesn't ring a bell.
Well, that was his first name. No, I think that was his last name. Anyway, that's besides the point.
Well, yeah. So when he came back, he was suffering from extreme PTSD. He had, as a sniper, the highest number of kills in military history, or at least U.S. history. And he, you know, showed many of the signs that you just enumerated in terms of his PTSD. But he started working at the Veterans Administration Hospital, kind of working with other veterans. And then there's the relative that you mentioned, and it sounds like she kind of on her own discovered that doing this volunteer work with other veterans was a form of restitution. And did that have any sort of a healing effect in her life that you're aware of?
Well, yes, I believe it did. And working with veterans in the hospital is one way that the restitution could take place. I mean, some of these veterans will be hospitalized for life because they have serious injuries, have lost limbs, and having a good life in a hospital is difficult, but it's not impossible. And social support is so essential, so important, and sometimes the family just gives up on them. And that's a shame because now they need family more than ever before. And, of course, an American Sniper, the central figure, thought that he knew everything about PTSD, and so he took a couple of veterans out to a shooting range, idiotically used live ammunition, and one of them turned on him and shot him dead. So you don't do things like that without professional help, without professional guidance. That's one of the lessons we can learn from that film. Clint Eastwood, the director of the film, called the film an anti-war movie, and I think that's basically what it is. There's controversy over it, but I don't think it glorifies war. I think it's a very anti-war film, and the PTSD is an example of that, where the American Sniper wasn't happy at home. He he was only happy going back into the battlefield and killing more of the enemy.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely agree. Now, have all of your own study been with in the context of military and war, or have you also studied accident victims, victims of rape, and other kinds of violent assaults? And do you think there are differences in terms of any of the principles that...
Well, yes. First of all, every case of PTSD is different. And this is why therapy is tough, because some types of therapy work for most survivors of PTSD, but they don't work for everybody. There is a type of therapy where an individual replays the trauma over and over again until it's drained of emotion. And that's one of the most popular types of therapy. Works for most people, doesn't work for everyone. Some people get re-traumatized. They get worse after that therapy.
Yeah, right, right.
And then there's cognitive behavioral therapy. Excellent for most people because it gets them to rethink their personal myths, their dysfunctional attitudes, their irrational beliefs. Again, it works fine for most people, but some people don't have the cognitive capacity to do that, especially people who have a traumatic brain injury on top of the PTSD. And so they need something that's more concrete, movement therapy, art therapy, something that they can do with their hands, something that doesn't require a lot of cognitive work, a lot of thinking. Now, one of our Saybrook students developed what I think is a very effective form of therapy, which is time-focused therapy. And he based it on the book on time perspectives by Philip Zimbardo,
yes,
former president of the American Psychological Association, a friend of mine. Phil heard about the therapy, and he encouraged Rick Sword and his wife, Rose Sword, to write a book with him called The Time Cure. And I think this is probably about the best treatment for PTSD around, because it takes people back and forward in time. And it also uses group support. It also gives homework assignments. It also pays attention to emotions. It has a very good track record in terms of following up and how symptoms can be reduced. So...
That's fascinating. I actually interviewed Phil Zimbardo about that book and about that work.
Wonderful.
And one of the things that came out of it was, you know, I asked, well, is the VA hospital implementing this? Are they excited about it? And so on. And he had a rather discouraging report that it's very hard to to move the VA on some of these issues.
It's very unfortunate that VA has not warmed up to the time cure. Very unfortunate. The bureaucracy in the VA has more or less settled on the two therapies that I just mentioned to you. And even a very good therapy like eye movement desensitization and restretching, EMDR, is not looked upon favorably by the VA. Despite the fact that it's evidence-based, it produces good results.
Yes.
So when you get involved with the VA, you are involved in the bureaucracy, and people sometimes make decisions that are binding, and so it's very, very difficult for a new type of therapy to catch their approval. However, things are even worse than that. Of all of the veterans with PTSD, only half go to any type of therapy. And of the half who go to therapy, half drop out after one or two sessions. So, at best, we have 25% of the people with PTSD getting any type of therapy. It gets worse. Less than half of the therapists they see have had any training in working with PTSD. So, the outlook is bleak, and I agree with Phil Zimbardo. that much more work needs to be done. Now, yes. You're talking about people who are not veterans. Yes, these therapies are useful for accident survivors, rape survivors, people who have secondary PTSD, who have PTSD simply because somebody they know has been traumatized. Also, there are people who have survived earthquakes, natural disasters, people who have survived bullying. As you know, bullying can drive people to suicide. And many teenagers literally have full-fledged PTSD as the result of the bullying, and they're very desperately in need of some sort of treatment. So
I'm missing a word there. As a result of what? It sounded like you were saying bullion, and I know I've got hearing issues. What?
B-U-L-L-Y-I-N-G.
Oh, bullying. Yes, bullying.
Excellent movie called Bullying that I would encourage your viewers to watch. It really interviews bullying survivors. It talks about some of the suicides that have resulted from bullying. Young people are bullied because they are fat, because they're skinny, because they're gay, because they're transgender, or because they're smart, or because they're a person of color, or they're a new kid in town. There are many, many, many reasons why yes. they're bullied. And it can be fatal.
Do you think that dream work could be useful in working with bullying victims?
Yes, absolutely. Some of my students have actually worked with adolescents who have been bullied and who show signs of PTSD, focusing on the dreams and, when they have a chance, getting them to use psychodrama, acting out the dream. That can be an effective way of dealing with PTSD dreams. You have to have a convenient group and a good therapist to do it, but you can use gestalt work, you can do psychodrama work, and you can do role-playing, working with dreams, and it can be wonderfully cathartic in terms of moving this emotional residue through the system, through the psychological system.
Yes.
I should mention one other thing about PTSD and nightmares. There is a type of dream called a lucid dream where people actually are aware that they're dreaming while the dream is going on. And there are now some technologies where people can learn how to have lucid dreams. Not everybody can do it. But if a PTSD survivor learns lucid dreams, they can become awake and aware while the nightmare is going on. And then they can make some of these changes from within the nightmare itself. Like in the case I just mentioned, they can apologize to the girl who they killed, apologize to the family, and do that within the nightmare itself. Take bullying, for example. If the nightmare is about a kid in school who is bullying the dreamer, well, the kid in the dream can actually beat up on the bullier himself or herself. Sometimes they can forgive the bullier, but that comes later. That requires a great deal of maturity that many teenagers are not capable of doing. But they can find some way to fight and win the fight against the bully in the dream, and that will provide a catharsis, a great emotional relief, and change the nightmare and also change their attitude. We'll give them some power, we'll give them some inner strength that can carry over into waking life.
Yes. Well, any other thoughts about dreams, dream work in relation to trauma of various sorts?
This is a huge topic. Let's talk a little bit about medication and nightmares. Some PTSD survivors are so desperate that they will take a type of medication that eliminates dreams altogether. Well, this is good for the short run. It gives them some solid sleep, which they usually don't have. you can't do this forever. You can't do this indefinitely because we need our dream time. We need those rapid eye movement sleep phases of the night. But as a temporary fix, one can do that while one is learning a better strategy and while one is going through psychotherapy. A lot of people who are PTSD survivors subsist on medication, but it's a band-aid approach. It changes the brain in the wrong way. It makes them dependent on the drug, and then they have to have more and more, larger and larger quantities of the drug, of the medication. Short-term, yes. Long-term, no, I'm afraid not.
Right.
However, a PTSD survivor has to change not only behavior, but has to change the brain. And the brain can be changed through good psychotherapy. The brain can also be changed through different types of martial arts, movement meditation. Sometimes silent meditation is not so good for PTSD because they can't focus well enough. Movement meditation, like the martial arts, like Tai Chi, like Jiu-Jitsu, like Taekwondo, okay, that's something that takes the PTSD survivor into the here and the now. It makes them mindful. In fact, mindfulness psychotherapy is very good for PTSD because it puts them right into the present and doesn't let them wander off into the trauma.
I know one thing that you've written about is post-traumatic strengths. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that the consequence of the trauma isn't always a PTSD reaction.
Yes, absolutely. The post-traumatic strengths is actually something we feature in our books, most notably in our book, Haunted by Combat. We have a whole chapter on post-traumatic strengths. But it applies not only to the veteran, but also to people who have survived bullying, who have survived accidents, etc. And that is to find ways to make them stronger. And that's why we emphasize the word survivor. They have gone through a traumatic experience that could have killed many, many people, could have ruined many, many other people, but they've survived. All right, what were their survival strategies? Maybe they got peer support. Some people get peer support by group therapy. Others go to Alcoholic Anonymous or a 12-step program. Some people have group support by going to a veterans organization. Also, there is now group support for gay, lesbian, transgender, and bisexual teenagers where they can get group support. So this is something where they can become empowered, they can learn from others, they can get tips from others, and this is going to produce a post-traumatic strength. Also, going back to the military, every soldier, every sailor, every Marine, every Air Force veteran has had a lot of money spent on them by the U.S. government developing skills, technical skills, leadership skills, strategic skills. They can pull upon those skills. They can pull upon them and find ways of applying those in their daily life.
Oh, interesting.
So, I tell the PTSD survivors who are veterans, don't waste time thinking about the trauma. Think about the skills. Whenever you have a flashback and something comes to mind in terms of your traumatic experience, just stop it and shift to something positive that happened. This is also part of the time cure that we mentioned earlier.
Yes.
Something positive that happened in the past. Change a negative past into a positive past and think of good times you had with buddies. Think of what you learned, the technical skills you learned. Think of the leadership skills, the survival skills, and how those can be used in everyday life.
You may be aware that Martin Seligman has received, I think, a lot of money from the government to institute a program designed to sort of give people, if you will, anti-PTSD skills to teach them resilience skills. Do you have any information or more current than I do or thoughts about that?
Yes, a lot of money was spent on the resilience program, and the follow-up studies have not been that encouraging, sad to say.
Uh-huh.
So it needs to be retooled. Let me tell you what I think that they've left out.
Okay, good.
And this is something that a lot of programs leave out, and that is meaning, the existential meaning of the traumatic experience. And sometimes one of the destructive personal myths that a veteran has is, the government has let me down. They sent me to fight in a war, and I still don't know what we were doing there. Neither do my buddies know what we were doing there. In fact, the positive memories I have are not of fighting some enemy that we couldn't see, but trying to save the life of myself and my buddies. Well, the Veterans Administration doesn't like to hear this anti-government talk. And a lot of therapists have never heard of existential humanistic transpersonal therapy, which gets to the core belief system, the core personal myths, and the core values of a person that are often shattered. PTSD can be looked upon as existential shattering, where one's whole worldview fell apart, one's whole belief in the government, in the leadership of the government, in the leadership at the top of the military fell apart. Same thing goes for civilian PTSD. A kid who is bullied, one's sense of the goodness of humanity falls apart. If people are good, why does this happen to me? One's religion can be shattered. Why did God inflict this upon me? Why did God let me survive and kill my buddies? Well, these are existential issues. And sad to say, the resilience program doesn't deal sternly enough with existential issues, but neither do a lot of the other therapy programs. This is one good thing about the Phil Zimbardo, Rick and Rose Solomon Time Cure. They get right into basic existential issues when they do this Time Cure program.
Uh-huh. Yeah, another person that I've interviewed who I thought had a very good program along those lines is Dr. Edward Tick. I don't know if you've come across him.
Right. Yes, very good work as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, he gets veterans involved in sort of Native American style rituals and all, you know, with drumming and also a lot of group support, which, as you were pointing out, is so important.
Well, as you know, I do a lot of work with Native Americans, and one of my recent books is called The Voice of Rolling Thunder. And it's the story of Rolling Thunder and his rituals and the way that he did healing. Now, he didn't live long enough to do too much work with PTSD, but there are many people, and they don't have to be Native Americans, there are many people who use ritual, who use drumming, who use group circles, who pass the pipe around and share memories. And all of this comes out of the Native American traditions. And I think that the use of ritual for PTSD is grossly underrated. And the ritual can be something that is a religious ritual, a shamanic ritual, or a made-up-on-the-spot ritual. A ritual is a step-by-step program to attain a specific goal. And if you put enough emotion into this and enough passion into this and enough creativity into it, oh, yes, this can be very, very therapeutic.
Yeah. You know, you've always got so many irons in the fire and things that you're passionate about. What else are you working on these days?
Oh, good heavens. The problem is the things I'm passionate about really don't pay the bills.
Yeah.
Yet I do them because I think they need to get done. The work that I have done with PTSD is all pro bono. I wouldn't think of charging any money for that. I've spoken to veterans organizations. I've even done demonstrations with people with PTSD nightmares, hoping that this will catch on and people will see some of the inventive work that can be done along these lines. But in terms of current work, yes, as you know, I am at Saybrook University and I am professor of psychology, which means I work with many students who are doing master's degree work and dissertation work. And I'm happy to say that we have three students I'm working with right now who will be doing their dissertations on PTSD. All three of them do a lot of work with veterans, and they're clinical psychologists. They can do the work much more effectively than I can do. They're creating one-page sheets that teach basic lessons about surviving PTSD. And then they use these in group discussions, and then people have something that they can take home and study.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yes, this is simple, but this is very, very effective.
And wow.
One of them is doing work with rituals. They're creating drumming rituals. Also, there is a therapist in the Bay Area, come to mention it, who is taking veterans out sailing and helping them have post-traumatic strengths by doing sailing expeditions. And this gives them a chance to use their military skills and have some fun, some group camaraderie, and again, put some passion into this to download the emotions that come with PTSD. So that's a little bit off what I personally am doing. But yes, I'm doing a lot of work with students. And they're not only working, of course, with PTSD. They're doing very creative work in invention, for example, in shamanism, for example. And I'm currently preparing a program for Munich, Germany. There will be a ethnomedicine conference the middle of May. Hundreds of people will be coming there, a lot of them doctors and psychotherapists, and there will be a couple of bona fide shamans from different parts of the world, and then there will also be anthropologists, psychologists, physicians who are skilled in native medicine. So what I'm doing is to prepare an introduction to shamanism for people who know the term but really don't know what a shaman is, and also to warn them about people who do workshops about shamanism and call themselves shamans who have never had the initiation, who've never worked with the community, who really don't deserve that title.
Mm-hmm.
So to be a shaman, you have to have three things going for you. You have to be given that honor, that title, that assignment by a community. Now, they usually don't use the word shaman. They use their own word for it. Secondly, you have to be able to get information from sources that are not available to other members of that community. Dreams, for example, drug states, dancing, drumming, sensory deprivation. I call those the five D's of shamanism.
Mm-hmm.
Shaman uses dreams, dancing, drumming, deprivation of sleep, and drugs, not street drugs, but peyote, ayahuasca, plant drugs that produce visions and give knowledge. And then third, the shaman brings that information back to the community and helps people in the community and helps the community as a whole. So without those three things going for you, you're not a shaman.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I'm working on.
Yeah, that conference in Munich sounds like it will be a really good one. And so speaking of conferences, maybe we should wind down here by you letting our listeners know why they should attend the IASD conference.
Oh, absolutely.
In June in Virginia Beach, Virginia.
Virginia Beach. go to the International Association for the Study of Dreams website. We'll get all of the details. Now, last year it was on the West Coast. This year it's on the East Coast. So your East Coast listeners, I will urge to go down for 5 days of intensive work with dreams, ending with a dream ball. It's a costume ball where people dress up like characters from one of their dreams, and where prizes are given to the most Freudian costume, the most Jungian costume, the most animal-like costume, the most nightmarish costume. It's a very, very festive evening after some very intensive workshops and lectures and dream tables. People get together at breakfast, and they discuss their dreams at breakfast. They learn many, many new ways of working with dreams. And there are some very good panels on research, where the latest research from Sleep and Dream Laboratories is presented. And there are families that go there, and Virginia Beach, of course, is right on the ocean, so there's a lot of recreational possibilities. And it's one of the highlights of the year for me and for the people that go there. And if they want to learn something about dreams, there's plenty of panels and events for beginners.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Stanley Krippner, I want to thank you for being my guest again on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's always a pleasure, Dr. Dave, and I'm so impressed that you've interviewed so many psychologists, and your listeners are getting quite an education if they tune in.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Stanley Krippner as much as I did. I think he's quite an amazing person. His knowledge of psychology is encyclopedic, and he's always been extremely generous in sharing, mentoring, and connecting people with the resources they need to move ahead. I've known him casually for about 45 years, and I've known many of the students he's mentored. He has such a deep expertise in so many facets of psychology, and he combines a remarkably open attitude to just about everyone and everything, at the same time with a strong commitment to rigorous research. I hope he won't mind my revealing that he's about 81 years old at this point, and yet he still has such a remarkable command of the literature, or I should say many psychological literatures, and so much passion for his many pursuits. I think you got a taste of this in the interview. At least I hope so. As always, you can get any of the many books by Dr. Stanley Krippner, including some of the titles he mentioned during our interview, using the Amazon.com widget in our right-hand sidebar. Finally, let me give one more plug for the IASD conference. That's the International Association for the Study of Dreams Conference, June 5 through June 9 of 2015 in Virginia Beach, Virginia. You'll find a banner ad in the left-hand sidebar on shrinkwrapradio.com that will take you to all the information about the conference. I'm not able to attend this year, but I'm passionate about the organization, and that's why I'm giving them this free promo.
Hello everyone, my name is Mike Hackett and I'm an accredited psychotherapist based in Dublin, Ireland. I'm delighted to mention that I've just become a jumbo contributor to Shrink Wrap Radio. Having really enjoyed the show for over a year now, I've found that Dr. Dave's interviews and his gentle reflections at the end of each has often left me feeling a renewed sense of passion and enthusiasm in my work, a sense of excitement in being part of a wider community of therapists and mental health professionals, and personally enriched by virtue of the themes and ideas presented in the show pertinent to my own development as both a person and a practitioner. I hope my small monthly contribution demonstrates my gratitude to Dr. Dave for his commitment to forging connections in and amongst us all. Should you wish to express your gratitude, I would encourage you to visit the Shrink Wrap Radio website and click the support button to keep Shrink Wrap Radio in our lives for many years to come.
Thank you, Mike Hackett. Wow, Mike, what a wonderful endorsement, especially coming from a psychotherapist such as yourself. There are thousands of you out there who have not clicked on that support button. Won't you please respond to Dubliner Mike Hackett's appeal and add your support to Shrink Wrap Radio right now? In fact, we do have three new supporters for our honor roll since the last show, and they are Helena Burton, Susan Hurd, and Jana Van Dyke. I'm pleased to announce a new sponsor for this particular episode. It's Casper.com, the Canadian online mattress company. I recently purchased one of their mattresses as a result of hearing other podcasters advertising them and talking about their own experiences with them. Plus, I've been experiencing some achy hips, and it's occurred to me that those aches might be the result of my old mattress. Up until about a week ago, I had been sleeping on the same mattress for who knows how many years, quite a few, I assure you. And I'd gotten that one from my daughter, who wanted to get rid of it. I would have, should have, replaced that old mattress years ago, but I hate shopping for mattresses. To me, they've seemed overpriced, the salesmen sometimes have seemed dodgy, and I can't really judge how well I like the mattress by lying down on one in a store environment for a few minutes and with the attendant embarrassment that entails. The Casper mattress solved all those issues for me. First of all, their mattresses are priced so reasonably as to make my price concern a non-issue. Secondly, they ship the mattress to you at no cost. And thirdly, you can try the mattress out for 100 days in your home. And if you are displeased with it for any reason, you can return it for free with no questions or hassle. You don't even have to put it back in the box. A driver will come and pick it up at your house. I've been sleeping on it for a bit more than a week at this point, and I'm totally satisfied, enough so that I'm getting rid of the old mattress. I should hasten to mention that Consumer Reports recently reviewed mattresses, and the Casper was among the top-rated ones. And I'm happy to announce that I'm able to offer you one of these mattresses for $50 off their already low prices. Just go to casper.com/shrink and also use my discount code of shrink at checkout. Several years ago, I attended a week-long shaman training workshop under the auspices of the Four Winds in Salt Lake City. The Four Winds is a shamanic training organization created and run by my former student, Dr. Alberto Violdo, whom I also interviewed on Shrink Wrap Radio number 31. Alberto had invited me to consider becoming part of his training staff, and so he offered me a sample experience. I've always described myself as a tough nut to crack, but I had a powerful, fleeting vision that stayed with me all these years. This was as a result of an exercise that we did in the training. And in the vision, I was being carried aloft over a vast forest by a giant eagle. It wasn't frightening or threatening in any way. Rather, it felt like a gift. I often thought it would be great to have an artist depict that for me. So I was very pleased to discover that one of my Shrink Wrap Radio listeners, Ann Maxwell, specializes in creating digital representations of people's nocturnal dreams. I'm so pleased with what she did with me that I want to share her work and promote her here. So here's a little conversation we recorded for you. Okay, so I have Ann Maxwell on the line. Hello, Ann.
Hello, Dr. David.
And you're somewhere in Australia, but I don't know exactly where.
Yeah, so I'm in a place called Hervey Bay, which is on the South Queensland coast on the Pacific. Okay. Just north of Brisbane is the biggest town.
Okay, and you're doing something called Dreamwell Art. And
yes,
you had made a donation to Shrink Wrap Radio, and I saw that in your email address, and that caught my interest. And I thought, I wonder what that's about. And I went to your website, and I saw that you had this amazing service. So tell us a few words about the service that you offer.
Okay. Well, essentially at the Dreamwell Art, what I'm offering is that a dreamer comes to me with a dream image or some kind of inner vision and I will render it as a digital image that the dreamer can use for their personal use, perhaps print it out or use it as a screensaver or, as you have done, put it on a website.
Yes.
So I'm creating a visual rendition of an inner image.
I'm not only putting it on my website, which people will be able to see at shrinkwrapradio.com/in the media. There's a tab called In the Media, so you can look for it there. But I'll also be printing it out and framing it and putting it on my wall where it can kind of inspire me, and I can kind of let it come to life for me and you know, see where it takes me.
That's so lovely. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was impressed by what you did. And we went through a whole process, and maybe you can just say a few words about what the typical process is.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you and I did, I would say, did fall within sort of the general structure of how it often goes with me doing these images with people. So essentially, the dreamer will describe their dream to me verbally or written form on email, say. And not necessarily the whole dream. Sometimes they'll just give me the scene or the particular image. But it helps me as much as they can give me, helps me, because then I'll get a sense of the mood of the whole picture,
sure.
Of, you know, what goes beyond the frame. And then as early in the process as possible, I do like to have the dreamer do a bit of legwork themselves and source some of the material that might either inspire or go into the final image. So like with you, I asked you if you would have a bit of a Google search and find some images of forests that would
yes.
be suitable to the vision that you had. Because a forest is not a forest is not a forest.
Right.
And there'll be different qualities of light and lots of things that really a picture is worth 1,000 words. And so there will be lots of things in an image that you might not be able to communicate just in writing. But not everyone has access to the internet. So some people, I've actually done the work of finding the source images and then checking in with them. And so then from all of that material, from the images and the description and the conversation that we've had, I'll go away and work up a few sketches, maybe three, four or five sketches. And I'll present those back to the dreamer, and the dreamer will say to me, I hope with great clarity, I love that bit, I hate that bit, blah, blah, blah. And we can hone down or try and hone in towards what the final image will be.
Yes, and I have to say that going through this process with you helped to revivify it for me, because I had had my vision, fleeting vision, some years ago, but
right.
It was strong enough that it was still kind of imprinted in my mind, But you asked me questions like, what direction were you facing? What was the time of day? What was the light like? And
mm-hmm.
all of those questions helped to bring it back. Well, we don't have a lot of time here to go into as much detail as I would like, but I would love for my listeners, you know, the idea of drawing a dream is something that I've used for years, and I know many listeners would be familiar with, of
mm-hmm.
doing it oneself. But the idea of having somebody else render it digitally,
right.
to me, that's a new wrinkle, and it was very, very exciting. And so how can people find your work?
Best way is to go to the website. So that's DreamWellArt. That's all one word, dreamwellart.com. And if they want to contact me, there's a contact page, or my email is info@dreamwellart.com. And sure, I'd love to have people just talk to me just to see if there's some way we could go ahead with making a dream image.
Okay, well, it's been great talking to you just now, and we'll see you online. We'll see
Definitely.
You listening to Shrink Wrap Radio.
For sure. I'm a big fan, and it's a real privilege to be part of your show here.
So there you have it. Once again, you can find Anne's website at www.dreamwellart.com. I recommend all you dream fans check it out.
Hi, this is Robert Haas, author, dream researcher, and instructor, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Robert Haas. That transition seemed particularly appropriate, inasmuch as Bob is one of the organizers of the upcoming International Association for the Study of Dreams conference in Virginia Beach that I discussed earlier with our guest Stanley Krippner. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag, and this one came on our voice message line. It's always nice to get one of those. This one is from longtime listener, naturopathic doctor Ralph Wilson, who recently moved to Hawaii. Let's take a listen.
Hello, Dr. Dave. This is Dr. Ralph Wilson. In some of my travels, I just listened to, again, the malignant narcissism interview. And it is fascinating because I just spent 15 years in Washington, D.C. And, wow, malignant narcissism is something I think I've had contact with out there. It's amazing. And as I listened to your letter to the editor at the end of that same talk, the writer is saying that possibly you feel that you're seeking, you're gathering information might be a sign of what kind of personality, a dilettante or a seeker lover. And I'm thinking more about that myself. I'm saying that you are not even a way shower, a way listener. You're not telling people, got to go this way. No malignant narcissism on your part, my friend. So thank you for being there, giving us all these opportunities to listen and then do what we feel and are or whatever, led, guided, clued in on. Wow, thanks for helping me get a clue. Aloha from here, Dr. Dave. Bye-bye, Dr. Ralph here.
So thanks to you, Dr. Ralph, for that response to my interview with Gary Bobroff on his approach to archetypal personality typology, and a big aloha right back to you. And I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, or you can leave voicemail, as Dr. Ralph just did, on our phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Stanley Krippner, for sharing his insights into the dreams of those suffering from trauma. My next interview will be with Dr. Clifford Sarin of the University of California at Davis, and we'll be discussing his extensive scientific research on the effects of meditation. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.